gained her doctorate degree at Northwestern University in 1987. She is professor and chair Northwestern University, which is in Evanston, Illinois, in philosophy. She is currently professor and chair of the philosophy department of State University of New York at Stony Brook, with a joint appointment in the Women's Studies program. She's author of 6 books with quite intriguing titles: Noir Anxiety, which is published by the University of Minnesota Press; Witnessing Beyond Recognition, again University of Minnesota Press; Subjectivity Without Subjects, From Abject Fathers to Desiring Mothers. And she has edited 9 others and published over 50 articles, chapters, and reviews in literary journals. She's also edited special issues of Hypatia, a journal for feminist philosophy, and Studies in Practical Philosophy, a journal for ethical and political philosophy. She's currently finishing a book entitled The Colonization of Psychic Space, in which she develops a psychoanalytical theory of the double consciousness of marginalized people. How very intriguing. Currently, she serves on the Executive Committee for the Society of Phenomenology, that is, Phenomenology and Existential Philosophy. The Vancouver Institute is indeed privileged to have such a renowned writer of philosophical issues to give us tonight's lecture, which is entitled, Why So Many People Feel Unloved and Unlovable. Please give your very warm welcome indeed, may I say a lovable welcome, for Professor Kelly Oliver.
Can you hear me? Can everyone hear me? Okay, great. Get used to the technology here. How do I put this? Okay. There are a lot of cords up here, so if I suddenly go under the table, I've been grabbed by one of them. First, I want to say that it's a great honor to be here, to have been invited by the Vancouver Institute to deliver this lecture this evening. So I want to thank the Vancouver Institute. I want to thank Bert Alsop for his kind introduction. I have recently moved to Vanderbilt University, where I'm in the philosophy department just this summer. So I've moved from Stony Brook. I also want to thank the Cecil and Ida Green, the benefactors of the Green College Visiting Professor Series. I very much enjoyed my stay this week at Green College. It is a special place, and I also want to thank Keith Benson, the principal of Green College, and all of the residents for making my stay so delightful. And I think that I've gained probably at least 5 pounds from eating the delicious desserts over at the dining hall. It's been very nice. And I want to thank also Sneha Gnu, who is the director of the Center for Research in Women's Studies and Gender Relations, for nominating me for the visiting professorship and organizing all of this and really making it all possible. I have had a very stimulating and exciting week working with the faculty, graduate students, and undergraduate students in the Center for Research in Women's Studies and Gender Relations, where there's some really exciting and significant work going on there. So I've enjoyed collaborating with people in the center. And finally, I want to thank y'all, picking up my Nashville, Tennessee accent, thank y'all for coming out tonight on a Saturday night to hear a philosophy talk, of all things. So thank you for being here. The title of my talk is Conflicted Love, or the Paradox of Love, Why We Feel Unloved and Unlovable. The popularity of self-help programs, yes, Okay, I'm sorry. Sure. Yeah, I think there's a sound guy in a booth in the back, like in The Wizard of Oz, who's supposed to be adjusting. Is my volume going up? Okay. Can you hear me now? Is it better? Not better. No. Okay. Maybe we'll have both mics. Maybe. Okay. We'll bring this one up. Okay. Does this? Can you hear me? No. Maybe I should move to this microphone. Okay. No, I think I'm going back to this one. Maybe if I move it, I'll move it a bit closer. Testing? Is it any better? Is that better? Okay, great. All right. We're on our way then. But, okay, I think we're okay back there. The popularity of self-help programs, various forms of therapy and counseling, antidepressant drugs, and New Age religion suggests a widespread search for meaning, acceptance, self-esteem, and ultimately for love. Bookstores across North America have self-help sections filled with books discussing how to find love, how to maintain love, how to rekindle love, how to feel lovable, and how to love yourself. Why, as a society, are we haunted with feelings that we are unloved or unlovable? Why do so many people suffer from feelings of meaninglessness, emptiness, loneliness, or the inability to love? Well, there are probably a lot of answers to this question, but this evening I would like to address this problem from a philosophical perspective, wherein I consider our primary assumptions about the nature of ourselves and assumptions about the nature of our relationships with others. In my recent book, Witnessing, which you'll see the cover here, I propose that a significant part of the crisis of love on a personal level and the crisis of peace on a global level is caused by our fundamental belief that as individuals we are at odds with others and with our environment, that dependence upon others is a sign of weakness, and that the relationship between the self and others is primarily antagonistic. The presumption that conflict is central to our relations with others is evident in various aspects of our lives. We feel disconnected from others and our surroundings because, as a culture, we assume that maintaining our individuality entails alienation. And this belief is the result of centuries of the development of Western philosophy, science, medicine, law, and culture. To make my analysis more concrete, this evening I will focus on assumptions about our first relationships, those with our mothers and fathers, that make it difficult to imagine ourselves loved and lovable. By pointing to conflicts at the heart of our stereotypes of maternity and paternity, we can begin to diagnose the paradox that undermines the possibility of imagining loving relationships. I will start with two sets of paradoxical assumptions shared by the history of philosophy, medicine, and law that set the stage for our conceptions of our relations with others. First, philosophers and psychologists typically assume that our primary relationships become models for our subsequent relationships. That is to say that our relationships with our mothers and fathers, particularly our mothers, shape all of our relationships throughout our lives. This is why so many types of therapy begin by analyzing those primary relationships. Paradoxically, however, philosophers and psychologists have also assumed But the infant's relationship with its mother is antisocial and must be broken off so that the child can properly enter society. How is it then that our first relation can serve as a model for subsequent relations if it's seen as antisocial? If the mother-child relation is imagined as natural, instinctual, or animal, rather than social or cultural, and if it serves as the model for all of our relationships, then really we have no hope of developing loving interpersonal relations or any kind of social relation whatsoever. As we will see, this is the first paradox of love. The second paradox involves our notions of the father's relation to the child. Philosophers have proposed that the father represents the authority of culture against nature, that he steps in to break off the infant's instinctual or natural relation to the mother and facilitates the child's proper entrance into society. Paradoxically, these same philosophers assume that the father's authority actually comes from nature. So how is it that the father's authority both moves the child from nature into culture and yet comes from nature itself? How is the father's authority both natural and the foundation of culture or society if nature and culture are opposed to each other? And how can the father be seen as a loving, embodied human being when he has been associated with abstract, disembodied authority and law? Analysis of these conflicts can indicate why our stereotypes about mothers and fathers make it difficult to imagine loving relationships. If on the level of our cultural imaginary, the maternal body is not social, then it cannot be an adequate model for subsequent love relations. If on the level of our cultural imaginary, the paternal function is not embodied, then it cannot be an adequate model for subsequent love relations. If all of our relationships are formed on the basis of these primary relations, then in order to imagine loving relations at the most fundamental levels, we need to imagine those primary relationships as loving. But if our stereotypes of mothers and fathers render these figures incapable of love at the most fundamental conceptual level, then it becomes difficult to imagine being loved in any relationship. My purpose this evening is to analyze the conflicts in our stereotypes of maternity and paternity as they are manifest in the history of philosophy and medicine, in particular, to point to more complex images of maternity and paternity, and therefore to more complex images of our primary relationships, images that promise the possibility of love. More detailed versions of these arguments can be found in my book, Family Values, Subjects Between Nature and Culture, which I saw they had outside. That's the cover of that one. I really like I used the images from the same artist, Remedios Varo, that one's a little dark, but the original image is very nice. Given the assumption that all of our relations are modeled on our primary ones, our relations would be modeled on our first relation to the maternal body, since at least technology hasn't advanced so far that all of us still have mothers. Yet the way in which the maternal body has been conceived within the history of medicine, philosophy, and our culture in general prevents this relation from serving as an adequate model for any subsequent loving social relation. First, as I've already pointed out, within the history of philosophy and psychology, the relation between the maternal body or mother and the child is assumed to be natural, instinctual, and animal, and therefore not properly social. Second, within the history of medicine, the origin of our relations are seen as hostile. Specifically, the relation between the maternal body and the fetus is figured as antagonistic. Given these assumptions, it is difficult to imagine our primary relationship with the maternal body or with the mother as loving. The first relationship with the maternal body, then, is in the paradoxical position of both providing the prototype for all subsequent relations and threatening the very possibility of any social relation. The paradoxical position of the mother is the result of the imagined opposition between nature and culture. Western philosophy began with a clear distinction between the body or animal and the soul or human. Plato proposed a dramatic antagonistic relationship between body and soul. Aristotle followed by insisting that it's man's capacity for reason that separates him from the animals. Bodies and animals are governed by the laws of the natural world, but the mind and human beings are governed by higher principles of reason. With its emphasis on reason against the body, philosophy has insisted on a sharp distinction between nature and culture. Within this scenario, only human beings are properly social. Only human beings have culture, and therefore only human beings love. The legacy of this mind-body dualism has been fraught with problems, not the least of which is the paradox of love. Within the history of philosophy and medicine, woman has been associated with the body and animal instinct, while man has been associated with culture and reason. Women have been reduced to bodily reproductive functions, while men have been disassociated from the body, instinct, and especially from emotion, in order to represent authority, law, and culture. But this dualism leads to the two paradoxes of love that make it difficult, if not impossible, to imagine these primary relationships as fundamentally loving at the deepest conceptual levels. In order to counterbalance this history that sharply divides nature from culture and animal from man, we need to investigate the borders of these binaries, particularly the maternal body as it stands between nature and culture, between animal and human. It is necessary not only to recover the maternal body from the side of nature and animal and place it within the properly cultural and human, but also to think or reason with the animal rather than against the animal, and to acknowledge its place within the realm of the social, and more important perhaps, acknowledge the animal's capacity for love. In other words, if within the imaginary of our culture, the maternal body or the mother cannot properly love because she is governed by animal instinct only in relation to her child, and animals are incapable of love, not to mention reason, supposedly, then we need to recognize both that the maternal body or mother is not just instinctual, but is also governed by social relations on the one hand, and that love is not necessarily excluded from the realm of the animal, on the other. I've been struck recently, for example, by the continual reference to the animal in the context of the prisoner abuses at Abu Ghraib in Iraq. It is common to hear that the prisoners were treated like animals. The most infamous photo from the prison shows Private Lindy with a naked prisoner on a leash. And in their testimony, some of the prison officials claim that they were ordered to treat the prisoners like animals, in particular like dogs. After forcing sexual abuses onto the prisoners, other prison guards were reported to say, quote, "See, they act just like animals." This rhetoric suggests that the abuses of the prisoners was justified by seeing the Iraqi prisoners as animals. Indeed, most torture and enslavement has been justified by claiming that the victims are less than human, uncivilized or barbaric, in other words, no more than animals. But when would we treat dogs in the way in which these prisoners were treated? It's unlikely that any of the prison guards involved would treat the animals in their midst in the way that they treated these prisoners. What does it mean within our cultural imaginary to say that some people behave like animals or that they were treated like animals when tortured or abused? Maybe some of you watched the U.S. presidential debate on Thursday, and you might have noticed that the only moment when Kerry and Bush agreed and laughed together was when Bush said that he was trying to put a leash on his daughters, as if they were dogs in need of obedience training. This rhetoric points to a tension in the way that we view the animal. In spite of the fact that as a culture, I think that we could say that we do not condone the torture or abuse of animals, and in fact, we have laws against some abuse of animals, paradoxically, we refer to abusive treatment as what we expect to be directed toward animals, even while we really do not accept such treatment toward animals, most especially toward dogs, which are also called man's best friends. And in fact, many of us count animals amongst our most important and loving companions. I often tell my intro to philosophy students, only half jokingly, that my cat Chaos is the meaning of life. And here you'll see why. There he is. The meaning of life, or now I've come to call him the porpoise of life. Our relation to animality, then, is full of the tensions of a relation to an ambiguous, perhaps even arbitrary border that assures us that we are human, that we're set apart from the other creatures of the earth, and that therefore we have the right to use them and the fruits of the earth for our own purposes without concern for their own well-being. While there is much more territory to explore in this borderland between animal and man, for my purposes this evening, I would like to move back to consideration of the maternal body and the mother's relation to animality in our cultural imaginary. If the history of our philosophy, literature, medicine, science, and law have considered the mother and the maternal body closer to the animal than to the human, then what does that say about our image of mothers, given the rhetoric of abuse justified by the talk of animality that I just pointed out? What does it say about women in our culture when the lightest moment in the U.S. presidential debate is when the president suggests that his daughters, like dogs, need to be leashed? Throughout the history of philosophy and medicine, the mother has been considered an animal acting on instinct in relation to the child, and the maternal body has been considered a passive container in relation to conception, gestation, and birth. For example, ancient notions of conception represented the womb as the fertile ground in which the male planted his seed. Both Aristotle and Galen, following him, held that the male contributes the soul, while the female contributes the less perfect body. The male element creates the individual or person within the maternal body. On this account, the maternal body provides merely the fertile soil within which the male seed implants itself and grows. The female is passive and associated with the animal, while the male is active and associated with the soul. This view held up until the 16th century, and the image that you're looking at now is drawn by Jacob Ruff in 1554, illustrating the view held by Aristotle and Galen of how the male seed develops in the container that is the womb until you get the figure of the little person. In the 17th century, however, the Aristotelian doctrine of epigenesis, that is the doctrine that the embryo develops, was called into question. In its place, scientists began to propose theories of preformation, that the human was preformed in miniature and merely grows rather than develops. With the theory of preformation, the male element provides both the form and the material of the child in miniature, and the tiny person merely grows in the maternal womb as the seed grows in the soil. And this is a drawing from 1694 by Nicholas Hartsucker, who claimed to see this tiny person in his microscope when examining sperm. This was one of the revelations of the discovery of the microscope, that he could now actually see the tiny person. In the 18th century, William Hunter's graphic illustrations based on his vast access to pregnant cadavers became extremely popular. In Hunting's drawings, the fetus is always shown intact, while the mother's body is always shown dissected. Again, the maternal body appears as a merely passive container for the fetus. And Hunter's graphic 1779 drawing here shows the dissected maternal body in the greatest detail, including, as you see, even the cut-off legs. This is actually pretty gruesome portrait of the maternal body as merely container. And in the 19th century, William Turner describes the relation between the maternal body and the fetus as one of opposition. He describes the fetus as, quote, a parasite at war with its hostile maternal environment. Many contemporary accounts of the relation between the fetus and the maternal body continue this language of opposition. For example, in her 1975 biology textbook, Elizabeth Ramsey attributes the formation of the placenta to, quote, an invasion of the fetal conqueror with its army of wandering giant cells. The fetus has gone from parasite to conqueror, but still in the 20th century at war with the maternal body. And our image of the very first relationship is then one of hostility and alienation. Is it any wonder, then, that we view subsequent relations with others as threatening our individuality or even our way of life? Don't like this picture, so I'm gonna. Oops. Oh, too soon for that one. We'll go back to that one. Don't want to make you look at that picture too long. In recent scientific literature, not only is the fetus at war with the maternal body, but also the male's contribution is at war with the female's. Biologists talk about the genetic development as a war between the sexes. For example, instead of figuring the interaction between male and female genes in conception as a negotiation or compromise, very recently, Dr. David Haig, biologist, figures conception as, quote, a war, an innate conflict of interest and the molecular arms race between the mother and the father. That's the way he describes it. And another biologist, William Rice, also describes an evolutionary battle of the sexes in which males and females are at war over who will dominate in, quote, a vicious knockdown, drag-out fight, quote, an evolutionary struggle cloaked in the deceptively cooperative act of consumption. Rice describes the adaptation between males and females through the evolution of mating as a physiological attack and defense strategies similar to adaptations by predator and prey. And the kinds of metaphors he uses are metaphors like chemical warfare, sperm as weapon, kamikaze sperm, and he talks about the rape, divorce, and prostitution among ducks. He probably didn't know there was divorce and prostitution among ducks, but the use of these kind of metaphors to describe behaviors that could be described using many other kinds of metaphors and models perpetuates the view that we're at war with each other from the very beginning of our lives. The maternal and paternal contributions to conception are figured as chemical warfare, a molecular arms race, while the relation between the maternal body and the fetus in her womb have been imagined as a hostile relation between parasite and host, or conqueror and vanquished. How can we imagine loving personal relations or peaceful social relations when our images of our very first relations are so full of the metaphors of war and conquest? Rather than figuring our first relations as hostile, antagonistic, or antisocial, however, some biologists and psychologists are beginning to see the interaction between the maternal body and the fetus in the womb as one of cooperation and communication that and also to see that within hours after birth, infants are responsive in ways that suggest that the relation between the infant and the caretaker is social from the very beginning. For example, the French biologist Helene Roche describes the placenta as a medium of communication between maternal body and fetus that transforms, stores, and redistributes maternal substances for both her own, the mother, and the fetus's benefit, such that the relationship between the maternal and the fetus is one of exchange and mutual cooperation rather than a hostile takeover by an alien parasite. And recent studies in psychology by Nicholas Meltzoff and Keith Moore show that infants are responsive to facial and manual gestures from birth, even prior to the recognition of objects. And here's a slide of some of their work. So you'll see that the infant is imitating, even just from a few days old, even a few hours old, they've done these tests, that the infants will imitate the facial gestures of adults. Following this work, Sean Gallagher and Meltzoff conclude that, quote, recent studies of newborn imitation suggest that an experiential connection between self and others exists right from birth that is already an experience of pre-verbal communication in the language of gesture and action. So these infants are born into a social system of communication, not just acting on instinct, the first in the gesture of language and action, and then eventually becomes the language of words and symbols. And here, you know, this different hairdo, I've adjusted the slide a little to make the comparison more, even more vivid in the imitation. There's also interesting work that's being done even more recently. Masako Miyawa at Kyoto University in Japan has extended Meltzoff and Moore's research to newborn chimpanzees and found that they too imitate facial gestures. You'll see the same gestures. Interestingly, though, his study found that as the chimps become more socialized into their own culture, into chimp culture, they stop imitating the human facial gestures. The study suggests that both the chimps and the humans have the innate ability to imitate gestures, but how these develop depends not only upon their physical differences in anatomy, but also on their cultural environment. To sum up so far, first, the opposition between nature or culture, or nature or animal, and culture or man, excludes animals from the realm of the social and love. Second, the mother and maternal body have been associated with the animal by philosophers and viewed within the history of medicine as passive containers existing to meet the fetus's or the infant's needs. This view reduces the mother and her body to animal instinct, which is then opposed to culture and to a proper loving relation. In turn, philosophers and psychologists assume that all of our relationships are modeled on this primary relation, which creates the first paradox of love. Moreover, the language of opposition between animal mother nature and human father culture and between the maternal body and the fetus or the infant makes it difficult to imagine cooperative and loving relations. If the mother's love is made paradoxical by the identification of the maternal body and animal instincts, the father's love is no more than an abstraction offset by the law and authority he supposedly represents. Within philosophy and psychology, the father brings language and law to break up the primary antisocial relation with the maternal body and usher the infant into culture. Obviously, with religious images in mind, particularly Christian images of paternity, the prominent French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan claimed that, quote, "For if the symbolic context requires it, paternity will nonetheless be attributed to the fact that the woman met a spirit at some fountain or some rock in which he was supposed to live." Well, this idea is not so far-fetched when we consider that until very recently with DNA testing, paternity could not be determined with certainty. While the mother's identity was more certain because she carried and gave birth to the child, the father's identity can be uncertain, even unknown. Obviously, the mother's body is implicated in the process of birth in a way that the father's body is not. But if the father's body is irrelevant to procreation, if the mother could just as well been impregnated by a spirit, what does that tell us about our cultural images of paternity in an age when so many fathers are absent from the lives of their children? As we will see, the absent father has been fundamental to the history of our idea of fatherhood and paternity. Moreover, as I can only suggest this evening, but argue at greater length in the book Family Values, show you that one again. In significant ways, the necessity of the father's absence is embedded in the rhetoric of family values and of manly responsibility. The association between the father and the law, the name, or authority makes the father an abstract, disembodied principle. Paternal authority is associated with culture against maternal nature. But in philosophy, it turns out that the paternal authority that legitimates culture and breaks with antisocial nature is actually founded on the father's natural authority because of his natural strength or aggressive impulses. The paternal authority of culture is founded on the father's naturally stronger body. Basically, then, might makes right. After grounding the father's authority in nature, our philosophers have disassociated the father from nature by then disembodying him. The father is physically absent from the family scene because he is part of culture, and the domestic scene is part of nature, opposed to, even threatening culture. Within the history of philosophy, even when he is present in the lives of his children, the father is present as an abstraction. His body is merely the representative of abstract authority or law. The association between the father and culture and the opposition between nature and culture or body and mind disembodies the father. In fact, his body threatens to fall back into nature. Just as the stereotype of the mother-infant relation as an antisocial, natural, animal relation does not permit love because love is seen as social and supposedly on the one, love is seen as social on the one hand, and supposedly animals don't love on the other. Love is not truly human, and love is not truly human if it's just instinctual or animal. The stereotype of the disembodied abstract father who represents the authority of culture cannot provide love because love also requires more than authority or a law. It requires an embodied, caring being. Western images of conception, birth, and parental relationships leave us with a father who's not embodied, who cannot love but only legislate from some abstract position, and a mother who is nothing but body, who can fulfill animal needs but cannot love as a social human being. And I'm talking about here the history of medicine and philosophy. This may not seem like our intuitive sense or even our everyday sense, but on the deepest conceptual level of what the historians of philosophy and medicine have presented us with, these are the images that they give us of mothers and fathers that we have all inherited at some level of our cultural heritage. It is commonplace that we associate the father with authority, the head of the household. From John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau to Jacques Lacan, father knows best. The notion of paternal authority and the father's leadership in the family as the ground for his leadership in society has a very long history. Yet there are conflicts in the history of philosophy and of liberal theory that grounds the authority of government and law in paternal authority. For example, both Locke and Rousseau present contradictory accounts of the relationship between the family and the state. Implicit in the theories of both Locke and Rousseau, and I don't have time to develop the argument now, but I do in the book, are the contradictory claims that the authority of political society is based on right and not on might, that only in nature does might constitute authority, and that civil society supersedes nature on the one hand. But at the same time, their work suggests that the father's authority is based on natural physical strength, that political society is based on the father's authority, and that the father's authority and his physical strength is what founds patriarchal culture. The father's authority is based in nature and physical strength, and yet it becomes the basis for a legitimate patriarchal government that is based in right and not might. But how then does the father's natural strength come to represent right and not might? How does the father transcend his natural authority based solely in his physical strength in order to take up his civil authority based in his moral and intellectual strength? This question is answered in the 19th century by Hegel, who moves man into the social at the expense of woman. Man can enter culture because woman never leaves nature. Whereas men are capable of higher intellectual life, women inhabit a realm of feelings, according to Hegel. And he says that, quote, women correspond to plants because their development is more placid and the principle that underlies it is the rather vague unity of feeling. Women, he says, are educated into this natural realm of feeling, who knows how, as if they were breathing in ideas by living rather than acquiring knowledge. The status of manhood, on the other hand, is attained only by the stress of thought and much technical exertion, says Hegel. Hegel describes how man leaves the world of the family and feelings and enters the world of the state and laws through the recognition of the women in his family who provide the support against which he can pull himself up to a higher level of consciousness. For Hegel, man's nature seems to be paradoxical in itself insofar as man's nature is to go beyond nature. But woman's nature is to tend the family, while man's nature is to lay down the law and enter civil society. While Locke and Rousseau covertly appeal to the father's might in their explanations of the formation of civil society and moral right, in the early 20th century, Sigmund Freud openly identifies moral right and civil law with paternal authority. Freud continues the argument that men are naturally more civilized than women who belong at home with the children. He says, quote, women soon come into opposition to civilization and display their retarding and restraining influence on civilization. Like Locke, Rousseau, and Hegel before him, Freud identifies the father as the first authority upon which the authority of all subsequent government develops. For Freud, civilization is based on man's repudiation and sublimation of his bodily drives, basically the repudiation of the body again. Yet the paternal repudiation of the body in favor of law and reason, for Freud, is actually based on the body. Again, another contradiction in this theory. For Freud, it's the anatomy of the male body that makes the repudiation and sublimation of the aggressive sexual instincts, as he says, possible. The male body is powerful only because it can act on its aggressive instincts in ways that the female body, according to Freud, cannot. Paradoxically, though, for Freud, it is not these acts that make men dominant, but rather the control over and repudiation of these aggressive acts. Men can control the body, but only because their bodies are so hard to control. The force of the control required to subdue the body is proportionate to the strength of the body. The sublimation of animal instincts into higher forms of culture is the result of man's triumph over his own virility. According to Freud, it's the sex drive turned back against itself that keeps animal instincts in check and allows their sublimation into culture, which is why, for Freud, women aren't as civilized because they don't have aggressive enough instincts, which means they can't really sublimate them. So you've got to have a very strong drive to control in order to enter civilization. Again, kind of a circular, contradictory sort of theory. Well, we might think that this attitude is a relic of our past, but it continues today in the rhetoric of family values that promotes strong paternal authority and the conservative diagnosis that the health of our nations depends on the moral fiber of our families. This appeal to morality in the political sphere sets off some alarms, or I think it should. First, the rhetoric of family values and moral fiber only thinly masks the patriarchal assumption that the morality of our children, and therefore of our nations, depends on strong paternal authority, and that youth crime, drugs, and gangs are a sign that single mothers cannot instill proper values in their kids. Underlying this rhetoric is the presumption that mothers are ineffective in disciplining their children, especially their boys, and that what we need is the return of a strong patriarch. In a post-election issue of Talk magazine, when asked, quote, what was the big innovation of the 2000 election in the United States, when Bush won, well, his media man does not say the voting booths in Florida or his brother Jeb or anything like that. George Bush's media man, Mark McKinnon, said, quote, values. What people are looking for in a president is a head of the family, a paternal figure to take care of us, a president dad. And Bush continues to be popular because of his image as a macho president dad type figure. The use of the rhetoric of values and morality in the political sphere also serves to turn social and political problems into individual moral and psychological problems. So crime, drugs, and gangs are not considered institutional problems, but rather the fault of some bad or sick individuals. By rendering social and political problems individual problems, governmental and social institutions can pass off any responsibility for addressing issues of poverty, housing, childcare, healthcare, etc. This is the all too familiar strategy of pathologizing and blaming the very people disadvantaged by institutional sexism and racism. For example, blaming inner city single moms, especially in the United States, African American and Latinas, are held responsible for drugs and violence. The appeal to the ideal of a macho paternal head of the household is also central to the popularity of the Promise Keepers Christian men's movement. And maybe some of you have heard of the Promise Keepers. Maybe some of you are Promise Keepers. Uh-oh. I hope you didn't bring any tomatoes with you if you are. At their events, which take place in sports arenas, and in Canada that's mostly hockey stadiums, and in the U.S. it's football stadium, men are called upon to stand up and act like real men. The supposition is that men have not been acting like men. Promise Keepers speakers claim that women have assumed the role rightly given by God to men, the role as leader and authority in the family. In order to stand up and be real men, men must reclaim their authority within the household by taking it back from their wives. And was interesting when I was reading the New York Times yesterday, because I saw in the art section of the Times an article entitled Old Time Sexism Suffuses New Season, talking about the new television season and the mainstream networks. And this article reports that in the new television season, we're not going to have any more strong women characters. Forward to that the comedies are back to making sexism and racism funny, and that the hottest new show is called Desperate Housewives. So, what we have to look forward to. The seven promises of a promise keeper advise men to take back their authority by approaching their wives and saying, and this is a quote from some of their literature, honey, I've made a terrible mistake. I've given you my role, I gave up leading the family, and I forced you to take my place. Now I must reclaim that role. Give it back. God never meant for you to bear the load that you're carrying. In one form or another, the message delivered by most of the Promise Keepers speakers is that the feminization of men and the authority given to women is destroying the family values of our culture. Tony Evans, a popular Promise Keeper preacher, writes that America is losing its families because of the feminized American males who have abdicated their roles as spiritual and pure leaders, thus forcing women to fill the vacuum. Another popular Promise Keeper speaker, Steve Farrar, says that, quote, when you take the major pressing issues that are facing us, violence, teen pregnancy, broken families, and reduce them to their lowest common denominator, you're going to find a lack of male leadership at the root. The presumption then is that the female leadership has led to violence, teen pregnancy, and broken families. The image of the Father modeled on a loving, macho God, or as a tender warrior, as they say, in a battle to regain his authority over his wife and children, is central to the Promise Keepers rallies at football and hockey stadiums across North America. And like most of the Promise Keepers rhetoric, the Promise Keepers Canadian website, which I looked at before coming up, is also full of sports and war metaphors. It contains menu bars such as Team PK, War Room, and King's Men. It talks of occupations and fortifications, and it calls the Promise Keepers rallies the Super Bowl for Christian warriors. The team or the army get together to fight to regain their authority in the family and in the culture, and to help each other fight against their own lust and adulterous impulses. This is another central theme of the Promise Keepers rallies, that men need to wage a war against their own sexual impulses that lead to lust and adultery. At their upcoming conference in Calgary, later this month, an entire program is devoted to, quote, every man's battle, which describes sexual purity as, quote, one of the greatest battlegrounds. Similar to Freud's account of sexual instincts turned against themselves, so that men learn to control their own virility and sublimate their sexual instincts into higher pursuits, the Promise Keepers also preach sublimation as a way of regaining authority in the family and in society. As their literature also makes clear, they're fighting a battle against the loss of meaning and values, attempting to counteract the meaninglessness felt by so many of us. And here's the forum, in case any of you want to attend the upcoming rally in Calgary, called Uprising. But you'll see that this forum, the conference forum, says, quote, in the search for meaning and purpose, we are faced with the dilemma to either simply exist or to move past mediocrity and discover that there is an urgent journey in which all men are invited to participate. But in this search for meaning and purpose, the Promise Keepers are also specifically targeting men and blaming the loss of meaning and values on the feminization of America. By getting in tune with their macho inner warrior who serves a macho god who's now seen as the commander-in-chief, men fill the void of meaninglessness, but again by using the metaphors of war and opposition that pits masculine against feminine, men against women, and rekindles the battle of the sexes. Moreover, these men are not just at war with women. Rather, they're actually primarily at war with themselves. The Promise Keepers rallies often use the military strategy of breaking men down and then building them up again so that they revel in self-hating in order to eventually find love in their warrior god. Their most recent convention campaign is called Uprising, as you'll see here, Turning the World Upside Down, or in the United States, Uprising, the Revolution of a Man's Soul. And the posters, again, are full of the rhetoric of war, uprising, and revolt. And prominent sports figures always play important roles in the conferences, which take place in sports arenas and combine a sports, military, and church-type atmosphere. Oops. Yeah, there's one slide I had of their poster, but for some reason I think it has takes up too much memory. It's not going to show you, but anyway. In some sense, against the philosophers who associate the Father with authority and law over and against the body and emotion, the Promise Keepers are trying to bring back the paternal body to the family. But the paternal body that they bring back is one full of pain and self-hate. A body that is full of sin and needs to be disciplined in the most severe ways. This body is guilty and needs to be purified by constant vigilance of other men and a military-type chain of command. Again, as in Freud's account of the paternal law, the father's authority is founded on a body turned against itself. And if the father's authority has been justified in the history of philosophy by his natural physical strength, now it's justified by an even stronger paternal authority, a macho god, who I might point out, whose body is also sacrificed. As I demonstrate in more depth in my book, Subjectivity Without Subjects, show you that title, in a chapter called The Morality of American Manhood, the first chapter, the Promise Keepers movement vividly shows us the contradictions inherent in our traditional views of paternal authority, and most especially the absence of the father's body and emotions in the domestic and in the public spheres. It shows the conflict inherent in our notion of the father as representative of authority and law, a macho figure at odds with his own body. In conclusion, these fundamental conflicts and inconsistencies at the core of our traditional images of both the anti-social natural mother and the anti-body authoritarian father can provide openings for exploring alternative conceptions of maternity and paternity. As I argue in Family Values, rather than threaten the social relationship or law and culture, the maternal body actually sets up the possibility of society and law, and therefore also of love. Body and emotion are not opposed to culture and law, but rather culture is born out of the body. Recall the images of the infant's first communicative gestures immediately after birth. The maternal body need not be seen as opposed to culture or the infant's proper entrance into society. And if the body is not opposed to culture, then the father's body need not be sacrificed either. If the father can be social and embodied at the same time, then paternal love becomes possible. Both the mother and the father can be representatives of culture, authority, and law, even while they're also embodied animals who straddle the realm between nature and culture. By bringing nature and culture together in our primary relationships, we can imagine subsequent relationships that are both embodied and social, and therefore also loving. Love is necessary both social and embodied, contrary to the images I think we've been given in the history of Western philosophy and medicine. So without prominent images of embodied emotional fathers and social rational mothers, the images of maternity and paternity in Western culture leave us with melancholy images of isolation, alienation, and unlovability. If we are to recreate images of ourselves as lovable and social, then we have to recreate love. And to recreate love, we have to recreate ourselves out of the possibility of loving mothers and loving fathers. As I suggest in my latest book that will be out by the end of this month, The Colonization of Psychic Space, we have to end the war between the sexes and the oppositional thinking that undermines the possibility of love. Only then can we imagine loving interpersonal relations, compassionate social relations, and peaceful national relations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Professor Oliver will be happy to take some questions. I'm asking that your questions be precise and short so that she can easily repeat them and everyone will then hear them. So please, your questions.
Comments, revolt, resistance.
Question over here.
Yeah, the question, and correct me if I am misrepresenting it, is that if humans are evolved animals, then outside of the religious paradigm, part of which I was talking about here, How are human beings any different than other animals in the natural, let's say in the animal kingdom, not the word you used, where the females tend the young and the males go out and hunt? Well, I have a couple of things to say to that. First of all, I think that, and I'm a philosopher, I don't really do field work, but I think that people who do, anthropologists who do field work, have shown that there, and you mentioned tribes, that there are matriarchal tribes in our own history and in our religious history. There have been matriarchal traditions and continue to be matriarchal traditions. In the animal kingdom, too, different species have very different ways of mating and reproducing and tending their young and tending to each other. There are species that mate for life. There are species that don't. There are species that operate in herds and so on. So I think that there's so much variety in what we call nature that it's very difficult to make the argument. I think that in general we could say that, you know, the males always do one thing and the females always do another thing, that this somehow points to some natural role. Also, as your question points out, if we think that human beings are particular types of animals that have cultures, that have language, that are social animals, that our relationships are certainly as much governed by our social relations than our biology and our anatomy and so on. You think of the history of medicine that I talked about here, but so many what would seem to be miraculous things that medicine can do. It just comes to mind, my sister had a liver and kidney transplant. You know, that was over 5 years ago. It seems like a miracle that, really, that she's alive and that sort of thing is possible. But my point is that as human beings, we've overcome what is traditionally seen as the natural in so many ways that I don't think it makes sense anymore we have to call into question, what do we mean by then the natural as it applies to human beings? And what I was saying was also maybe we should take it a step further as in terms of our relationship to animals. How are we going to make those divisions between nature and culture when we have animals living in our midst as sometimes our best friends or our loyal companions? So really, I was suggesting that we really need to blur the boundary, or at least call into question the boundary between nature and culture. And I guess what I was taking issue with the biologists were the metaphors that they use. It's so full of metaphors of war. And I pointed to the history of medicine and the history of philosophy, and we might think, well, that was, 100 years ago, or that was 1,000 years ago in some of the examples I gave, but it's not. It's still in contemporary biology, and the latest quotations that I were reading were from very contemporary recent biology that just use the metaphors of war and arms race and rape in contexts where even if there is some kind of a tension or struggle, it wouldn't have to be figured as a hostile, warlike tension. Tension can be very good. It can be very productive. It could be a conversation. It could be figured as a debate. I mean, there are lots of different metaphors that could be used. So why do we keep coming back to these metaphors of war, which is really my point, that as long as we keep talking about a battle between the sexes, war between the sexes, and use those kinds of metaphors, especially in our medicine, our science. I mean, these are scientists in their scientific journals, philosophers, that it's going to be very hard for us to imagine peaceful relations because we keep figuring our relations and here I just talked about our primary relations as antagonistic and full of war. And thank you for your question.
Mm-hmm. Any questions, please?
It seems to me that in my lifetime, the battle between the married couple is often being control of the church. This, I'm not talking about my own family, but this is in place of my family, my parents, so often. But when I was a child, I've seen many adults. The man had a dog, and the woman went where he wanted, and he gave her a ride. This seems to have been a common pattern. I am always stunned and surprised as I'm talking with some of my friends now who are revealing what their lives were like, that this has been the case and is still the case in our children. I'm talking now about people in their 30s and 40s. I'm still hearing this, it seems, that the man is, especially the single, is still running the show. I'm just surprised to find this case. I just want to make one personal comment, and I like your comment on this. You think this is still, if there is any improvement in the generations of my children who were born in the 50s and 60s, I just want to make one comment. When I got married in the Anglican Church in 1954 in Vancouver, B.C., the chairman said that I would love, honor, and obey. I discussed it with the minister of the church, who assured me I had to obey no man. I discussed it with my husband in advance, which was a mistake. But because it led to a bit more discussion than I wanted, but I went ahead and had a conversation with him, and he really does understand that. But I think my husband is one more advanced than several of our children's generation. I'd like to come to that.
Thank you. Did everyone hear, or should I? I don't know if I can repeat that, but thank you. I think that maybe I can just get to the bottom line, which she has given very interesting stories from her own life that suggest that, for example, when she married, she was asked the church, the standard language was that you would honor and love, honor, and obey your husband, and that she had to have conversations with the minister and her husband about obedience, whether the woman really had to obey the man. And also, she was pointing out that it seems like the battle ground is really financial in terms of marriages or relations between men and women, that traditionally men have held the jobs and women have followed them and women have gotten an allowance and haven't had financial independence. And she's asking, it seems to her that what she's seeing is that this is unfortunately still too often the case. And has there been any improvement or not in these terms, I guess. Is that a fair kind of representation? Okay. I think, first of all, I guess I would say the fact that I'm up here addressing you suggests that we've made some progress. Because usually you would have a man here addressing you in a lecture series like this, or, you know, probably 50 years ago, it would have been very rare for a woman to be addressing you in a prestigious lecture series such as this one. It would have really had to have been a truly outstanding woman. But I think that, again, studies have shown, our sociologists have shown, that there is a glass ceiling, that in terms of finances, it's still true that women make less for the same type of work than men. And I can say, speaking from my own personal experience, I truly have felt that I have had to do two or three times as much, probably, as a man to get the same kind of recognition as the men in my field, which is philosophy, you know, also a very male-dominated field. And I feel actually privileged to be part of that discipline and privileged to be part of the conversation, and I've been willing to do the work. But that's the thing. I think it still takes women. Women are still expected to do twice as much for the same recognition, not just in terms of honors and so on, but in terms of real financial security and financial independence. And So I would say that I think that we have made improvement. I think that there's still a long way to go, I think, before we can even imagine anything like a true equity between men and women in our society, which in North America is supposedly one of the more advanced societies in terms of its treatment of women. But you also, you know, I could go on and on talking about domestic violence and violence against women, and the rates of violence against women in our so-called developed, progressive Western societies are horrendous. And so it's, you know, women are paid less, there's more violence toward them, the violence is not really taken seriously in the same way, and so on and so on. So I think that although we have made progress, and I feel that I've been the beneficiary of many women who have struggled hard and gone before me, there's still quite a lot to be done.
Question over here.
That's a very interesting question. The question, as I heard it, is that with my presenting such a negative thesis of maternal and the images of maternity and paternity in our culture, could it be that being an orphan or brought up an orphan could actually make it possible to have more loving relations? That actually it might be better in terms of love. Maybe I could extend the question in terms of meaning, feeling, self-esteem, to be brought up an orphan. I don't know about that. I think that then we would have to investigate our cultural images of orphans, our cultural images of abandonment, of bastards or illegitimate children, of unwed mothers, of adoption, and so on. So I don't think it's a question that can be answered out of the context of the cultural kinds of analysis that I was presenting. But I think maybe what we could say is that given the images of maternity and paternity that we get in the history of our philosophy and in the history of much of our medicine, we are orphans. We all are orphans in the sense that at the deepest conceptual levels, we don't have images of loving mothers or loving fathers. We get these contradictory images that give us mothers who, if they love, their love is just an instinct. What kind of love is that if it's just given by instinct and nothing more than that? And we get fathers who represent authority and responsibility and have to take on that responsibility and are expected to go out of the house, but are also disembodied and in fact seen as weak if they show emotion, I think still in our culture, and that's one of the things that I think the Promise Keepers, I mean we don't have to just turn to the Promise Keepers, but men showing emotion is still seen as a sign of weakness in our culture. So I would say that in a sense we are all orphans if we're born out of a war between the sexes and mothers who are reduced to animal bodies and fathers who have been reduced to disembodied laws. But it's a very interesting question, and I'd have to think about that more. Thank you. That is an excellent question, which is, what do we do? What do we do now? She's asking, do we do to get back into our bodies? How do we reform the use of these metaphors? And I think that there are some biologists, for example, I just briefly mentioned Helene Rusch, but I think there are others who are doing research that uses metaphors of the same subject. They're seeing the same thing, you know, but that uses metaphors of cooperation. It's like the example that I showed you of the drawing that Nicholas Hartsauger made in the 16th century of what he actually saw in his microscope. That is what he saw. And so now a scientist, a contemporary scientist, looking at the very same sperm in his microscope, obviously is not seeing that little person there. But and yet, this is what he saw with his own eyes. So I think that it's going to take a lot of perceptual shifts and shifts in metaphors and shifts in the way that we conceive of ourselves. And I think that there are some scientists and some philosophers and writers who are sensitive to that. I think that on every level, I think on wherever, whatever you do, whether you're a business person, whether you write poems, I think there are ways in which you can be attentive to the kinds of metaphors that you use or the kinds of language that you use when you talk about human relations, whether it's relationships between you and your coworker or relations between men and women, the way that you think about relationships with your husbands and wives and sisters and brothers and so on, and that maybe you can sort of catch yourself when you find that you're talking in that language of conflict and war between the sexes and that sort of thing, and that when you read these studies in the newspaper that conclude that we are fundamentally antagonistic, conflictual beings and use metaphors like chemical warfare and nuclear arms race and prostitution of ducks, that you can be more reflective in the way that you receive that and think, well, that's interesting. Maybe there's tension in this relation they're describing, but isn't it a little extreme to start calling some negotiation, say, if we call it a negotiation between genes, a molecular arms race, and this sort of thing? So just to be critical in the way that we read the newspaper and accounts of our science and to, in whatever ways we can, hold ourselves and our philosophers and scientists and the pundits of our cultures more responsible.
Right at the back, there's a question.
Yeah, I'm wondering just how arbitrary security is the structuring and security, and whether it is just a matter of kind of replacing them because we just do a series of actions or whatever happens to come up with all these responses and so forth, or whether there might be facts that matter about, for example, human stone age or something that we can replace with images of cooperation. And if there was such a situation, would you advocate shifting and changing the metaphors to be more cooperative if this reflects the fact of the matter is that because it has the positive effect of making people feel more loved and loved and it's not open to the situation. So if what you're saying is right, there's a kind of rhetorical
okay, I think that will have to be the last question. Comment or question?
Okay, I will try to repeat your question. This very tricky question is from a philosopher who's also a postdoc here that I met in Green College, so I'm not surprised that a philosopher would ask such a complicated question. Very sly and way to end the presentation. But anyway, his question is that if, and let me know if I misrepresented your question, that if the images of maternity and paternity are arbitrary, if they are accidental, as I've suggested, so you say, are there any facts of the matter? And if there are facts of the matter, should we, if the facts turn out that the caveman kinds of cultures were hostile or men dominated women, now I'm kind of expanding on what you said, should we just ignore those facts of the matter because we want people to feel lovable, and we should replace those facts with metaphors of kindness and cooperation and love so that people will feel lovable? So in other words, you concluded, should we disseminate falsehoods instead of the truth so that people will feel better, you know, so that we can feel better about ourselves and feel warm and fuzzy? Well, this is a complicated question to answer because first, I did not claim that the images of maternity and paternity were accidents or arbitrary. I think these images serve very particular political purposes. There are benefactors of these images. There are victims of these images. So they're not accidents. They're not arbitrary. They have real consequences, and there are facts of the matter, and those are some of the things that I was saying in response to earlier questions. There are facts of the matter even today about the difference in the amount that women earn for the same kinds of work. There are differences in the reporting of domestic violence and the violence done against women and the way that women are regarded in our culture, and I think that if our popular culture is any indication, it seemed like we were seeing more images of strong women and women heroines in our films and on TV, but that seems to be changing, and even in some of those cases, we like to see them, women getting killed off. First, I guess in our films, we're seeing everyone getting killed off. So, but there are facts of the matter, and so I wasn't suggesting that the images were arbitrary, but I do think that they're, at least what in talking, let's just talk about contemporary biology. In some of the studies that I quoted, these biologists are really using very flowery language and metaphors that don't accurately describe what they're seeing in terms of interactions between genes. I mean, in the interaction between the genes in conception, which is what Dr. Rice was describing, there is not a molecular arms race. I mean, what does that mean to say that there is a molecular arms race? You know, that there's some kind of, you know, that this is not just war, but this is now a nuclear war between these genes. So, I wonder whether these metaphors are accurately reflecting the truth of, or the facts of the matter, and that's what I would call into question. And maybe I can see why it sounded like I was saying that, well, let's just change the way we talk about these things. But I think that there are some scientists who are using different sorts of language, and that we need to attend to the language of war and opposition in our cultural heritage. And I don't believe that if we move now from the discourse of medicine and biology back to philosophy, I don't believe that we can conceive of our fundamental relationships with each other as human beings as conflictual and antagonistic and or full of alienation, and then get from there to imagining any kind of loving interpersonal relationships or any kind of peaceful social relationship. So if we start from the presumption that were fundamentally at odds with each other. And I didn't go through the whole history of philosophy. I can give you lots more examples, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre, Hell is Other People, and, you know, I don't have to go back to the distinctions between human and animals and that sort of thing, but it's all over, the idea that even in contemporary philosophers continuing the discourse of the self and the other, and that we define ourselves by rejecting the other, and that's the only way we can get a sense of ourselves, and that's what we do as nations. As nations, the only way we can get a sense of, you know, patriotism or of nation or any group, the only way it can get a group identity is by excluding somebody else. And I think if that's where we start, then it's no wonder we end up with war, and it's no wonder we have such a difficulty as a culture imagining love and the possibility of love and compassion.
Ladies and gentlemen. May I ask Professor Sajjad Dandev of UBC's English Department, Director of the Center for Research in Women's Studies and Gender Relations, to express your appreciation on that.
Well, we might have the same problem, but I think you can hear me. I think that, as you've shown, I think in your response, that Kelly Oliver is a very different kind of promise keeper. She's a person who shows very clearly that someone with a great breadth of knowledge, lucidity of articulation, a great deal of erudition, she comes to us as someone well-versed in 19th and 20th century philosophy, in French philosophy, in French feminist philosophy, is able to transmute that into a kind of public intellectualism that speaks very much to our times. And I think it has been wonderfully exciting, albeit too brief, having you here for the last week. We've had a series of conversations with Dr. Oliver in all kinds of fora. She has been remarkably generous in the way she has interacted with our community, and I'd like to just tell you that when she came in a few days ago to Canada, the welcoming immigration officer sent her off to a lineup for people who were trying to enter the country. Now, she had to wait in the lineup for 4 hours before she was actually able to explain her situation. And we were rather horrified at this experience that she recounted to us. But I think in retrospect, perhaps he was picking up on something, a wish that we had that she really would come and emigrate to Canada. At the very least, I sincerely hope that she will be back again soon and that we will have the pleasure of her company again. Thank you very much.
Just a final announcement, please. Professor Oliver has graciously consented to sign any of the books that are outside on the display table, which you may wish to purchase. I would like to remind you that next week is Thanksgiving, and there will be no lecture, and subsequent Saturday will be Professor Ransom Myers. So we look forward to seeing you then, and thank you for your presence this evening. We had 50-50 questions, one male and female. Thank you.